In this talk, I will report on some work made in collaboration with Sylvano Bonazzola, Thibaut Damour, Philippe Grandclément, and Jean Novak. But most of the talk will be a kind of review talk about gravitational wave from binary black holes. So this is the plan of the talk. After some introduction, I will, in fact, successively describe the three phases of this phenomenon. First, the spiral, which is the farmost understood phase. And then the last stable orbit, when these phases terminate. And then what we know, and we will see it's quite a little thing, about the final merger. So as an introduction, we can say that gravitational waves are the only waves which comes directly from black hole, because for astrophysical black hole, at least, the Hawking radiation is completely negligible. And what, of course, is motivating us very much is that the gravitational wave detectors are now coming online. This is a view of the Virgo detector, a French-Italian Virgo detector in north of Italy. It's similar to LIGO in the United States, and on a slightly smaller scale, GEO in Germany, and on a also smaller scale, TAMA in Japan. So this is 3 kilometer by 3 kilometer Michelson interferometer. And of course, there is the space project LISA that we have heard about a lot in this conference. So let's present why studying binary black hole. From gravitational wave detection point of view, they are considered as maybe the most promising source for the detectors, the interferometric detectors. From a pure theoretical point of view, it's really an interesting problem because it is the two-body problem in general relativity. It's pure gravity. There is no complication like turbulence, accretion disk, things like this. It's very clean, very simple problem. It is also the final merger of two black holes can be considered as extreme general relativity, and it's interesting in probing the limits of a theory when you consider it as a weak field limit of string theory. And so we observe this. Maybe we will have some indication of alternative to general relativity, possibly. From the astrophysical point of view now, as we have already heard yesterday, of course the rate of these events is related to the evolution of massive stars. We can also, because we are measuring directly distance with these gravitational wave signals, say something about cosmological parameters, H-naught and Q-naught. And also, if we observe at high redshift, we can say something about large structure formation in the universe. So, the evolution of two black holes is different from the two-body problem in Newtonian theory because they are spiraling and they are coming close to each other and finally merging. This is because in general relativity you emit gravitational radiation, so you are losing energy and angular momentum in this process. And we have an observational proof of this. This is the orbital decay of a famous binary pulsar, so we know it's true. And another effect, apart from shrinking the orbit, is as Scott mentioned earlier, that gravitational radiation circularizes the orbit, so we can consider that we have exactly circular orbits. So this is a sketch of this in spiral motion, and then we reach some, possibly some less stable orbit, and then we have a plunge. I will show more details in a few minutes. We can consider two types of binary black hole in spiral merger. Depending on the mass of the black hole, there are the stellar black hole from standard stellar evolution, and there are some event rate in the universe. I mean, not, we will see after the detection rate. It's around 20 per million year per galaxy. And also, if we consider binary black hole formation in global dark cluster, as we heard by Simon Portugues-Svart, this is, in fact, a higher rate. Also, we have supermassive black hole, and remember the talk of Christian Menu yesterday. The end rate is quite known, but possibly quite important. And what is, I didn't mention here the intermediate mass black hole discussed yesterday by Cole Miller, because it's not clear yet if we can find a binary of two intermediate mass black holes which merge within one Hubble time. Or, you know. The interesting thing from a theoretical point of view is all this is the same physics, because everything scales with the mass of a black hole. So we have only to study one thing. This is a typical gravitational waveform that we expect. So there is this first phase that's in spiral, and then we can expect some plunge, possibly, and some merge of the two black holes. So I put a quotation mark here because this part is highly uncertain now, and this is quite well known. And also the final phase is well known, because what we expect is simply the ring down of the excited Kerr black hole. And then this excitation by gravitational wave emission with a strongly damped mode and high frequency mode like this. So let's study the first stage in this process, the in spiral. So the waveform is the so-called chirp waveform. It means that this is a waveform where both the amplitude and the frequency increase with time. And at lowest order, you have such formula, and you see that both the amplitude and frequency decreases with time, like this. And it depends on only one parameter, which is the so-called chirp mass. This is this combination of mass, should be minus one, one-fifth here. And this is okay, fundamental constant. So this was the lowest order formula. There are more precise formula, which are developed in the framework of post-Newtonian theory. And this is the state of the art in this field, obtained by Luc Blanchet and collaborators. This is at the 3.5 post-Newtonian level. You have this formula for the phase, because there are two corrections in this. First correction, that the phase is quite complicated here. And also, you have other terms. You have more harmonics than simply this harmonic here in full general relativity. For instance, you have up to six harmonic at the 2.5 post-Newtonian level. And so unless the chairman gives me 35 more minutes, I can describe each of these terms. And you see, it's really impressive formula. For instance, here, this is the Euler constant, which appears in this formula. And so it's nice to have a physical formula with Euler constant here. And also, by detecting gravitational wave emission with high accuracy, you can measure both pi and the Euler constant. So, but let's come back to the simple formula that we have here, the lowest order formula. From the simple formula, we can estimate the chirp time, the characteristic time of variation of it, by taking the time derivative of f. And what we obtain is a very simple thing. So this is the characteristic time of variation of f, is simply related to this. And in terms of chirp mass and the frequency, it is given by that formula. And we can plug in some numbers in this formula. For two stellar black holes, 10 masses, the chirp mass is that value. And when it enters the Virgo Liger band, it's around 10 Hertz. It means that the chirp time is 100 seconds. This is the characteristic time scale. The coalescing time step is 3 over 8 of this time. So it's typically a few tens of seconds. For supermassive black hole, when they enter in the Lisa band, it is 10 to minus 4 Hertz. And the characteristic time is 100 days. And notice that from this formula here, you see that if you form this combination, the amplitude times tau, so the amplitude is given, maybe we can have a look here. It is given with this power and this power here. And if you form that combination with f squared, so each of these quantities is a priori measurable quantity, you obtain something with only fundamental constant and the angles of the direction of the event in the sky, but this you can resolve with at least three interferometers, and then you get the distance of the event. So you can use this as standard candle. But I won't go too much into details here. So this was the waveform. Now what we detect really? What we detect is a combination of these two gravitational wave modes, the two polarization modes H plus and H cross. And this combination depends on the direction of the source in the sky and also on the polarization angle with respect to the detector arms, by means of two trigonometrical functions, in fact, which define the beam pattern. But what we measure, unfortunately, is not this. It's this plus the noise. And this is the output of the detector. And in gravitational wave physics, the problem is that the noise is of the same order and possibly larger than the signal itself. So signal filtering is absolutely necessary to detect something. And I just want to sketch very briefly how this is done. If we assume independent the sources of noise are independent in each frequency band, then they add in quadrature, so you can introduce some density of noise like this. Signal filtering simply taking correlation with some filter of your the output of a detector, and you define the signal to noise ratio by this formula, the expectation value of this divided by the root mean square when the signal is absent. And there is a very important thing, is the Wiener theorem, that the filter, among all the filter, possible filter, the one which maximizes the signal to noise ratio is given by this formula in terms of its Fourier transform. And you see that in that formula, the signal itself enters, as well as the noise. This means that an a priori knowledge of the signal is required to apply that filter. You have to know in advance the signal. And once you know it, with this Wigner filter, the signal to noise ratio is given by that formula. And can make this is just to show this function square root of S, the noise density, for in the case of a Virgo signal, just to give some figures. So this is the 10 hertz and 1 kilohertz. And here you have 10 to minus a few, 10 to minus 22 or something like this. And well, I don't want to enter too much into details. Just we can make a simple from that formula here. We can make a simple approximation to get this. We have a square root of n. This is just assuming that this is constant in the frequency observational frequency band, and that you observe in a bandwidth delta f of width f centered around f. And n is simply the number of cycles. It's f times the chop time. And so this is given by this formula, so that you obtain a formula like this. And what is important to keep in mind is that the signal to noise ratio depends with this power of a chop mass, 5 over 6, so roughly 1. So the bigger, the more massive the event, of course, the easiest it is to detect it. And so this is comparing various detectors. This is a ground-based detector, and this is design space, so a cloud frequency between 10 to minus 1, 10 to minus 1. And this is for instance, 10 to 6 solar mass black hole, at Zn equal 1, so you see that it is well above the sensitivity of LISA. And not that these curves are decaying like this, although the amplitude itself is increasing, but it is that because this is in terms of signal-to-noise ratio, so that most of the time is spent in the low-frequency band, and so this is why it's like this. Yeah, but I think I don't have time to detail this. Right. So taking into account the sensitivity curve, we can speak now about the event rate in the detectors. For stellar mass black holes, we expect the first generation to be sensitive up to 100 megaparsec, and second generation, for instance, what is called LIGO 2, 10 times further, it means 1 gigaparsec. We go to possibly one event per year, which is not that much, but since you are 10 times further, it means that you explore a volume which is 1,000 larger, so that you can expect a daily rate for the second generation. At the supermassive black hole, you observe everything, in fact, not to Hubble radius. So if few, maybe more, maybe much more, it's not clear yet. So now, this was the in spiral signal. So now I want to focus on the last stable orbit. It means when this in spiral, this chirp terminate. This is a crucial problem for the detection. It's well known that for very small mass ratio, you have a last stable orbit at 6m, at least for Schwarzschild. This corresponds to that frequency in terms of m. But for equal mass ratio, the situation is not so clear, because strictly speaking, you cannot speak about circular orbit, because you have the in spiral. So that the last stable circular orbit has a priori no exact meaning. But you can define in the equation of motion a conservative part and a dissipative part. The dissipative part is related to the reaction to gravitational radiation. And if you compare the two, this is an exact computation up to the second post-Newtonian order, you see that during most of the time it's comparable, and this is the adiabatic part, only the conservative part, and this is with dissipative terms. So it's reasonable to assume that most of the time you can consider circular orbit, and that the last table circular orbit is defining as a turning point in the binding energy curve. So there have been two approaches of this for finding this turning point in the binding energy curve. One is analytical, and second one is numerical. And the analytical one has been conducted now up to the third post-Newtonian level by two groups, Damour, Jarnowski, and Schaeffer, based on the effective one-body approach, which is a kind of resummation of standard post-Newtonian techniques. And there is a standard post-Newtonian point mass approach by Luc Blanchet. Numerical computation on the other side have been based up to now on the initial value problem of general relativity, and means solving only the constraint equation in a three-dimensional hypersurface. And this has been developed essentially by Cook, and there is a variant of it developed by Baumgartner. And the main point is that there has been a big discrepancy between these two computations. It's the same physical problem, so there should be only one answer, and there was two answers, and this is resumed in this figure. This is the binding energy. This is the ADM mass minus the, if you want to say, the predictable mass of a black hole. So this is binding energy, let's say, as a function of frequency. So the binary system evolves on these curves. The frequency is increasing as the orbit is shrinking. And this is the third post-Newtonian order, so it's high order in post-Newtonian expansion, effective one body by Thibaud Damour and collaborators. And the turning point is here, around that frequency. Notice that the naive Schwarzschild 6M would be around here. So it's quite different from a naive 6M in R on roughly 0.07 times M in omega. And this is the numerical approach based on the initial value problem by Cook. And you see roughly you have a factor of 2 in omega, in frequency. So it means that there is much more Titan orbits than this one. So it was really a big discrepancy, which can we can summarize on this figure here. This is the binding energy obtained by various numerical methods. You have two groups, roughly speaking. The post-Newtonian group, up to third order post-Newtonian, by two methods, the effective one body by Damour and collaborator, and the standard, the post-Newtonian by Luc Blanchet. Let's give this value here, and numerical value based on the initial, numerical result, sorry, based on the initial value problem. And this is in geometrical units, but if you want to translate in more classical units, when you are here at 0.1, this gives you, for true solar mass black hole, this gives you 320 Hertz. So in our group in Meudon, we propose a new approach to this problem, a new numerical approach, different from previous one. It was also based on the notion of exactly circular orbit. And the idea was not to treat, as Cook has done, the initial value problem on the three-dimensional hypersurface, means solving only the constraint equation of general relativity, but instead to consider a full space-time with the approximation that the orbit do not decay, that we have we neglect the in-spiral phase, and we are really considering orbit. So we are in the adiabatic approximation. And of course, we introduce, this is an approximation, but we have a full space-time. And in particular, the fact that we have a full four-dimensional instead of three-dimensional in Cook treatment enables us to have a rigorous definition of angular velocity, because when you are just on a free slice, you cannot rigorously speaking about angular velocity. So the results have been published. And this is mostly the work of the PhD thesis of Philippe Grand-Clément. So geometrically speaking, this approach of exact circular orbit means that your space-time is ordered with some Killing vector. It means that you have a symmetry generator, where you have lines of symmetries in your space-time, which have like this helical shape here. But I don't want to enter too much into the details. This is just to show you the set of equations that we have to solve. We assume as an additional approximation that the metric is conformally flat. And this means that we have, in fact, to solve only 5 of the 10 Einstein equations. They are listed here. And this is one more equation than the initial value problem of Cook et al. They solve only the 4 constraints. Here we have one more equation, which may explain some differences. This is the way we determine omega rigorously in our method, but I don't want to enter into too many details. We define a constant evolutionary sequence of more Titan and Titan orbits by this requirement that the energy, total energy of the system with respect to total angular momentum, which are well-defined quantity in general relativity, and in fact, this is only 2 well-defined quantities, global quantities, are related on omega and on this. And we can see that by some mathematical theorem by Friedman and collaborator that this is equivalent to saying that the area of the event horizon of a black hole are constant during that process. And we can check this. First, this is a check that our prescription for omega gives the Keplerian law, the third law of Keplerian, when the 2 worlds are far apart, which was not obvious at the beginning, but now it's fine. If you see the way we compute omega, it has nothing to do with Kepler law and things like this. So we were very happy to recover Kepler law at large distance. And this is a test that the area of the event horizon is conserved during the shrinking. It varies with less 1 to 10 to minus 3. So it's very satisfactory. This is for 2 numerical resolution. So this is an extremely good test of the code because it's really not imposed in the code.
What are the two curves?
It's 2 different resolutions. A numerical resolution, number of points in the grid, if you want. And this is an example of what we get at the end. This is the last stable orbit configuration, the minimum binding energy. This is the Laplace function, square root of GTT, if you want, in some sense. This is 0 on the horizon here. And then it goes to some value. But this value, not that we are in very strong field, but because here between the 2 holes, it is only 0.6, whereas it should be 1 in flat space-time. Also notice this is not our computational domain. Our computational domain extends to infinity. This is only for drawing purpose that we cut it like this. And even if we go far from a VR, like here, notice that we have only 0.8 for the Laplace function, you mean that the redshift is 20%. So this is extremely relativistic configurations, of course. And this is our result as compared. So remember the green ones, it was this discrepancy between analytical method and a numerical method. This is Cook's result based on the initial value problem. And this is our new results. And you see we have 2 resolutions. This gives you an idea of a numerical error in this. So our binding energy is from here. And we are considering co-rotating black holes and not the irrotational ones. So we cannot compare directly with a green one, but instead we should compare with that one, which is the third order post-Newtonian effective one-body approximation for 2 co-rotating black holes. And you see the agreement is very good. And this is second order post-Newtonian. You see the necessity to go at least up to third order. This is second order post-Newtonian, and this is third order post-Newtonian, which match quite well with our result. So this is a summary of this. This is our new results. So it goes, this is numerical, and it goes in the post-Newtonian regime, and it's far from these things here. And now, so this was the end phase of the in-spiral. Now, of course, what is interesting from a strong field point of view is the final merger. And I put this because I think that the definitive answer will be in the next, can be given in the next meeting. But this is serious. I mean, I think the time scale now for computing this is of the order of 1 year. It's not of 10 years or thing like this. We are really approaching this now. And there have been already some attempts to go with it. And a recent one has been by Baker, Brugmann, Campanelli, Lusto, and Takahashi. They have computed from some from the Baumgartner data, the Baumgartner ISCO, so which was the best one at that time, but now we have seen that it's no longer that one. So Baumgartner data, it is this point here. So now we think that the astrophysically relevant one, which represents really two bodies, two black holes orbiting in our universe, is here. So let me maybe detail a little bit. How much?
You still have lots of time.
Okay. This is perfectly valid solution of Einstein equation. It's a good solution in that respect. Simply, it does not represent something in our universe, something which corresponds to two bodies on circular orbits. Because when you solve the constraint equation of general relativity, you have a lot of degree of freedom. You find exact solution of Einstein equation, but you have some parameters. And all the point is to fix these parameters so that your configuration corresponds to some astrophysical system in the universe. And the prescription in this computation was simply bad, so that we get a factor of two. And we could not buy, simply when restricting yourself to a three-dimensional surface, you cannot say something about the whole space-time and the orbits. And so this is why we are in much better agreement. So coming back to this. So this first attempt used this initial data, which are bad, but at the time this is all was on the market. Also the time evolution was quite crude. It uses what I call old-fashioned ADM. It means why it's a formulation of Einstein equation which is not known to be not very stable. And also a zero shift, and it means that you don't take into account the lens steering effect, and if it's rotating things, this is very bad. But so the code crashes after only 15 m, and remember that the orbital time is around 60 or 70 m at the last stable orbit. And also it crashes before a common horizon, apparent horizon forms. But the spirit of this method is quite good, is to combine full numerical relativity and to plug some linearization perturbation based on the Tokoski equation that Scott was mentioning, so a perturbation of final curve black hole. And a more recent approach is currently in progress. It's not published yet, by Ed Seidel group in the Albert Einstein Institute, and we are collaborating with him in the framework of our network, which is called Sources of Gravitational Waves. There are 10 nodes in Europe of this network, and Meudon and Potsdam, the main node is Potsdam, the PI is Ed Seidel, and Meudon is a node of this network. And they are using our data, this initial data that we think are astrophysically better than previous ones, to compute the evolution. And so we are using completely different method to get this data than the method that will be used in the time evolution. In particular, we're using spectral method to solve a partial differential equation where they are using finite difference. And let me show, but this is very preliminary, so I cannot show you any result yet of this. What I can show is the result of a new code, the Albert Einstein Institute code, with good coordinates, co-rotating coordinates, with some shift, not zero shift as before. But starting from bad, let's say, non-realistic initial data. Once again, let me repeat this. This is perfectly valid from Einstein equation point of view, initial data, but simply from astrophysical point of view, it's not relevant. And so there is a little movie here. Possibly, yes. You see, now the black hole are merging. So this is really orbiting things, more or less. And it's merging, and a common apparent horizon is forming. So it's going one step further than Becker et al. And the Lazarus team, because they are able to have a common apparent horizon. And so now they are repeating this computation with our initial data, and the result should be available in a few weeks. Or I don't know exactly. Okay. Let's stop this. So this is to summarize the various stages. So in these things, I want to summarize by discussing the total energy emitted by gravitational radiation from this process of coalescing black holes. There exist from a long time ago absolute upper bounds, which are very high, and they are deriving by Hawking simply by assuming that during such a process, the total area of the horizon should increase and cannot decrease. This is the second law of black hole thermodynamics. And you see that if you assume only this law as a limitation, you can radiate up to half the total mass energy in your system in the form of gravitational wave. This is the case where initially you have two maximally rotating curved black holes, and by some process, they merge to form a non-rotating black hole. So this is the most efficient way. But astrophysically speaking, it's difficult to imagine it. And if you have initially non-rotating black hole, you can radiate only up to 30% of total mass energy. So what's in the in spiral? So this was upper limit on pure theoretical ground, but based on this second law of black hole thermodynamics. So what are the results now from real computations? So in spiral stage, we can read here. This is the binding energy, and so this is the in-spiral part, and the in-spiral ends when you reach the last stable orbit. So you see, depending on the method, it's around that value. So it's something between 1 and 2% of total mass, so it's not that much. The plan and merger phase, as you have seen in this, we don't have any definite answer yet because simply it has not been computed rigorously yet. So we are waiting for the numerical relativity computation for this. But there have been some arguments which have been given by Scott and co-authors saying that in that phase, it can radiate up to 10% of the total mass. And then there is the last phase, this strongly damped quasi-normal mode of the final black hole. And you can see that by some argument that you cannot radiate, some argument also, so some numerical result. This is numerical result, and this is a, let's say, theoretical a priori argument. You cannot radiate more than 3% roughly of the total energy. So this gives you the value. So you see that we are quite below the maximum absolute bound. This is in terms of energy. So I arrive now at the conclusion of this talk. So first point that I have tried to show, and which is quite obvious to most of you, is that the gravitational wave signal that we expect are very weak, and the detector are dominated by the noise. So it's not necessary to have adapted filters, and adapted means that you have to know the form of the signal you are looking for in advance. I mean, you have to know it theoretically. So this is why theoretical computation of these gravitational waves are absolutely necessary. And so this theoretical computation have been conducted for the in-spiral phase by means of analytical method up to a very high accuracy, the third order post-Newtonian expansion, and it's well described, and there is no problem. The only problem which were until not long ago, it was when does this in-spiral ends? So this now we think because of these two approaches, our numerical approach and the post-Newtonian approach, that we have more or less a clear answer of this. We know when the spiral ends. This is the last stable orbit, the ESCO. The fact that we have an agreement between such very different methods means that we can really rely on the result. We can say that, well, the post-Newtonian method is very good, and why do you need a numerical relativity then to go? Well, even in this regime, it was the extreme limit of what post-Newtonian method can do. For instance, it was there was used some kind of resummation techniques. This is the spirit of this effective one-body method. So it was not clear that it was okay, but the thing that we have a good agreement, I think that it assesses, in fact, both methods. And also, the numerical method, of course, does not treat the black holes as point mass particles, but as extended particles. So tidal effects and Villac-Weiss are automatically taken into account. And also, something that the post-Newtonian method does not do, at least at the present stage, is to provide initial data ready for time evolution by time evolving code. And initial data means that you have to give a free metric on a three-dimensional surface and the extrinsic curvature of that surface. So this motivates the numerical approach. And what I mentioned is that it seems that if we look in the progress made in this field, that the full merger starting from this initial data should be feasible in a few years. So maybe even in the next meeting, 3 years from now, hopefully one can report about these results. Okay, and that's the end of my talk.
talked a few times about realistic conditions, physical conditions going into the instrument. For what you consider realistic conditions, what's the pitch angle, meaning the ratio of the radial velocity to the azimuthal velocity when it crosses the instrument?
It's of the order of, it's not one, but it's not far from one, I guess, because it's when the plunge is starting. And for, as I said, it's not very well defined, this notion of E score for equal mass bodies. And we see this a better figure is that one here. You can see here on that figure that this is more or less the answer to your question if you look to that angle here. And this is the post-Newtonian second order last stable orbit. So for equal mass body, this is equal mass body. And it means that it's difficult to say if it occurs here or here. So you have not a sharp cut like in Schwarzschild case. But still, you have something.
So are you implying that people are now certain that these codes will not develop instability?
They can develop, but on long time scale, and because every numerical code possibly has some instabilities. But now the fact that people are capable of forming a common horizon gives us good hope that we could compute this. I have to mention that this movie that I've shown you, starting from Gartner data, it was with higher angular velocity, as we have shown. So it means that it's more tight in orbit. So it will be more difficult to start from our realistic initial data because they are not as tight. So it will require more computational power or new methods. So. But because we are using methods which are based on Cartesian coordinates on a cube, and that we can devise methods based on spherical coordinates, as we're using in MEDON, we're using spherical coordinates and with various patches to describe the spherical object like a black hole. Basically, we have spherical topology, so we think that spherical coordinates are far more better, you know, to describe this object. So we can think about various approaches to that problem, and I think it becomes really feasible now.
And you will no longer be using the conformal simplification of the metric?
No. It will be a conformal decomposition. It means that you extract the conformal factor, but then you have a full 10 component metric, or 6 component for free metric. So.
I'm a little surprised that you think you'll have this done in 3 years, evolution of the mergers. I'm curious, there's also degrees of freedom associated with the magnitudes and directions of the spin of the black hole.
So, yes, you have to explore in a parameter space with many degrees of freedom. And this, of course, is not feasible within 3 years because of computational argument. But at least one simple computation. For instance, our initial data, it assumes co-rotating black hole, which maybe astrophysically is the relevant case because of a strong viscosity that you mentioned of case of black hole. It's possible when the black hole are close to each other that they synchronize by means of tidal effects. And so this is one set, so well-defined. We have co-rotating black hole, and we have no other degree of freedom. It's co-rotating. So we can evolve from this and present the result for this. And then we will evolve for, let's say, irrotational things or things like this. But of course, to give templates and to explore full parameter space, no, it's not feasible maybe within 3 years. But this, I meant only to do at least one more or less correct computation. This is the aim.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm just wondering exactly how you do it.
Yes, this is what I had here. This is this helical symmetry that I was speaking about. It's more than initial value constraint. In fact, we are solving the constraint, and we assume that we have a killing vector like this. We call it helical killing vector because it asymptotically it is like this. And it is that combination of these two vectors, which are not killing vectors in the binary case. And it is like this. And so this is one simplifying assumption in this computation. But our aim was to get some approximate solution of Einstein equation, but at least something which represents more or less two black holes which are orbiting on more or less circular orbits. This was our aim. Our aim was not to get a 100% exact solution of Einstein equation. This was our spirit. So this is a simplifying approach. And in particular, this is not compatible with the full Einstein equations because you cannot have such an exact symmetry unless you have some incoming gravitational waves from infinity to compensate the outgoing one to have some stationary configuration. But if you're asking for asymptotically flat space-time, if you are doing this, you are violating some of the Einstein equation, and this is some of the five that we do not solve. So we solve for a subset, which is five of the Einstein equation, which encompass first order post-Newtonian, for instance, and we are solving for this five Einstein equation, and with this there is no problem. You can have an asymptotically flat solution.
Any other questions? If not, let's thank our speaker again.